We are back into the Kuzari in our regular scheduled topic, which is at the beginning of Ma'amar Sheni of the second essay.
What page is it?
It's on page 143 in the Kuzari.
Page...
Ah, good. You haven't missed much. Okay. Now, the topic, starting with page 143, and going through the next few pages, which we're going to try and run through a little bit more quickly than normal. I'm not sure how much ground we'll cover today because I want to take a look at another text today until we get to around page 150 or 151. Really may seem somewhat arcane to some of our ears because what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is about to embark upon is an attempt to explain how we understand the descriptions of Hashem that we find in Tanakh in a way that is consistent with acceptable Jewish theology. And what I mean by that is that we have a certain tradition that God is indescribable, and yet there are descriptions of Hashem that any way you try to describe him, you seem to be in violation of the indescribability of God. Now, a little bit of background is really in order over here. And that is that as much as we've described in the past Rabbi Yehuda Halevi as being the anti-philosopher, he really very much is a product of his society, of the philosophical milieu of the medieval period in Spain. And as much as he has a certain negative attitude towards explaining Judaism through a philosophical lens, he cannot help but be caught up in the entire framework of his world, which views certain basic concepts from a philosophical foundation. Okay, so when we talk about God, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is not talking about God in a vacuum, just looking at Tanakh. He's talking about God using a framework not only of Tanakh, but also a framework of Aristotle, also a framework of Neoplatonism, also a framework of conceptions of God that were circulating throughout society that were universal to the Islamic, Christian, and secular communities. And the reason why I mention that is because one of the great projects of the medieval philosophers, the time in which Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is living, is to try and describe the metaphysics, the not only the physical world, but also the metaphysical world and how our universe interacts with the movers and shakers that are above us. And when I say the movers and shakers, I mean, you know, there's something called the prime mover. Or the prime cause, depending upon which philosophical text you want to read. But the prime mover or the prime cause is another way of describing God. But certain Greek philosophers had a very non-biblical understanding of what God is, sort of the controller of the movements of the universe, or the cause of all causes. But you have to really appreciate that these are ideas that are circulating based upon an attempt to understand how everything comes to its existence in the way that we find it in this world. This was the attempt, this was the philosophical project to try and explain God in a way that would fit into a larger philosophical model of explaining all that exists. And when people like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, or like Rabbi Sadyagam, or like the Rambam, or others like that, try to explain God in the way that he is reconciled, the way that he is described in Tanakh, what are they reconciling that with? They're reconciling it with the philosophical depiction of God, who is elevated above any frame of reference that we have in this world, who is completely devoid, necessarily, of any physical features or characteristics, because that's the way philosophy defines him, because philosophy equates physicality with defect in thought. Okay. And so we have to appreciate that when we read about...
Excuse me. So what time period would that be like in history? Like what?
Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is in the 12th century. He's in Spain. He's in a milieu, a cultural milieu, which is very heavily steeped in scholasticism and philosophy. And the world around him, primarily it's an Islamic culture, is also, it's part of this basic secular education that every child gets in school, is an Aristotelian depiction of the universe and the God who runs the universe. So that's important to know when we read about this struggle that our classic commentaries have with the way that Hashem is depicted in Tanakh, and also the way that philosophy depicts Hashem. So therefore you see the Rambam devotes a tremendous amount of effort and space in the Mor Nevuchim and in his Yad HaChazaka to try and emphasize to us that despite the anthropomorphic depictions of Hashem that we will find in Tanakh, God is devoid of any kind of physical attributes. Right? That's the project that we're working with over here. I photocopied a while ago, we never had a chance to look into it, a text from Derech Hashem, which is from Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. We're fast forwarding about 500 years from the time of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, 500-600 years from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. The Ramchal is in the 18th century, and he also is a product of that very same milieu, but he has other things that he has to concern himself with. The other considerations that the Ramchal has is the Kabbalistic literature that he is very much a product of and that he feels is his project that he wishes to perpetuate. But when it comes to a depiction of God, we find an intersection between Kabbalah and Zohar and the way that many times the Greek philosophers depicted God. There are very, very common sort of transcendent depictions of Hashem, which the Ramchal therefore feels he needs to preface in talking about the universe. Derech Hashem, the way of God, is a really required reading for everyone. Feldheim has a few editions of Derech Hashem, all wonderful and good, with very, you know, the Ramchal was a master at categorizing information, at even esoteric information, even very abstract and metaphysical information, and providing it to us in a digestible format. So I figured let's take a look and see how the Ramchal approaches this, and that maybe use that as our launch pad for trying, it's a little hard to read, sorry, and use that as our launch pad for trying to understand Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's explanation of the Creator. So he starts off, this is the Creator, this is the very first chapter of Derech Hashem. Every Jew must believe and know. I'll just read, this is Arya Kaplan of blessed memory, this is his translation. He was a master translator as well. Every Jew must believe and know that there exists a first being without beginning or end. So already we are seeing a philosophical terminology that is being employed by the Ramchal. He is basing himself upon the Rambam. And the idea of a first being is, again, prime, a prime being that is the cause of all causes, without beginning or end, who brought all things into existence and continues to sustain them. This being is God. Again, using philosophical logic, an infinite being can have no beginning and no end. And that's how we define God. It is furthermore necessary to know that God's true nature cannot be understood at all by any being other than himself. The only thing that we know about him is that he is perfect in every possible way and devoid of every conceivable deficiency. These things are known by tradition from the patriarchs and prophets. With the revelation at Sinai, all Israel perceived them and gained a clear grasp of their true nature. So the Ramchal is telling us that even though I've just used a philosophical definition of God, don't be misled to think that I have arrived at this definition through philosophical logic, which, although is cogent, nevertheless is subject to refutation. Rather, he says, our understanding of Hashem, which coincides with the philosophical understanding of God in many ways, is based upon a Masorah. It's based upon a tradition that comes to us from our patriarchs and from Har Sinai. With the revelation at Sinai, all Israel perceived them and gained a clear grasp of their true nature. They then taught them to their children, generation after generation, until this very day. Moshe had thus commanded them by saying, you shall not forget the things that you saw with your own eyes, and you shall make them known to your children and to your children's children. Now, this is very much consistent with something that we're going to learn in the Kuzari as well, that Rebbe Yehuda Halevi will tell us at some point that everything that the philosophers got right about the metaphysical realm, and especially about God, it's because they first got it from King Solomon's court. Now, as understand that for Rebbe Yehuda Halevi, there are certain universal concepts that are postulates or axiomatic. But it's not that the philosophers just pulled it out of thin air, but rather they received, there was a circulation of knowledge of all of existence that ultimately traces its way back to Maamad Har Sinai, ultimately traces its way back to the revelation at Sinai. So even if we pull some esoteric idea about God from the Greeks originally got it from us. The Rambam writes this as well in his Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, but in a slightly different way. The Rambam writes that when we study physics and metaphysics, those Greek subjects about God and his universe, we're not studying secular knowledge that is non-Torah related, but we are rather just restoring esoteric knowledge that was lost from our tradition because of centuries of persecution, and we are taking it back, that which is rightfully ours, that the Greeks had pilfered from us. It's a fascinating concept. The question that I've asked, I think I may have raised this before, and you can ask yourselves sort of like a thought experiment. Would the Rambam be able to take a Greek textbook, philosophy textbook, into the bathroom with him? Right? Because if the knowledge of science and physics and metaphysics really is part of Torah and is part of the tradition that was passed down to us at Har Sinai, so then can you study it? Is it holy and therefore you're not permitted to study it in the washroom? Or do you have to make a Birkas HaTorah before you study Greek philosophy? Would be another way of putting it.
If we receive this through the Torah, why would anyone who's not Jewish be expected to believe in God?
That's an excellent question. But your question is predicated, you're making an assumption when you're asking this question. Who said that non-Jews are expected to believe in God?
Well, they have the Shiva Mitzvah B'nei Noach.
Okay, so how do they know the Shiva Mitzvah B'nei Noach? Are they supposed to intuit those commandments on their own? There's a famous essay by Rabbi Chanan Wasserman in his Kovei Tzama Amarim, where he ponders the question that if the Gentile were like Tarzan, right, brought up by apes in a jungle, right, from the age of infancy, would it be incumbent upon that human being to believe in God? In other words, would that be a basic human obligation? I mean, you can ask that question about other basic human instincts as well. Is it instinctive for a person to know not to kill? Is it instinctive for a person to know to respect his parents? Is it instinctive for a person to know a number of different things that you and I take for granted because of the culture in which we've been brought up? And so it's a good thought question, and there are arguments to be made on both sides. But I don't know necessarily that we have to answer that question right now. The truth is that if a Gentile is expected to know about God in a vacuum, then you'd have to conclude that God embeds within each Tzelem Elohim an intrinsic knowledge of Hashem, and therefore it's incumbent upon each individual to discover that which already exists within himself or herself. If that's not the case, and there are arguments to be made on either side, then the only way that a Gentile would be held responsible for the fulfillment of the Shiva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach or any other commandment is if he had access to that information and was instructed by a Jew or some other source that there are such commandments.
So 99.9% of the people in the world don't have that access. So then we're not expecting them to believe in God.
I didn't say that. I said that there are arguments to be made on both sides.
The second way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is prohibited for a non-Jew to be an idolater. And it seems that the Gemara holds them responsible. Whether the Gemara holds them responsible because they should have known, because all human beings at one time had access to this information, or because of a tradition that goes back to Adam and to Noah, or whether it's because every person is supposed to intuit this on their own, is a bit vague in the words of Chazal. Okay, so let's go on with the Ramchal. We're up to the bottom paragraph on that page, where it says, these concepts can also be logically verified by demonstrable proofs. So he's hedging his bets here. In other words, he's covering all his bases. Not only do we have a Masorah about God's essence, which is indescribable and not definable by any frame of reference that we have in our lives, but we also have proofs to this as well. Their veracity can be demonstrated from what we observe in nature and its phenomena. Through such scientific disciplines as physics and astronomy, certain basic principles can be derived. And on the basis of these, clear evidence for these concepts deduced. We will not occupy ourselves with this, however, but will rather set forth the well-known basic principles handed down by tradition. These we will present in an authentic framework arranged in a comprehensive manner. So the Ramchal has already told us what his project is. My project is not to prove God's essence and nature using science. You can. I'm not going to tell you how, but you can. Now, there are other Jewish works of this genre that do set out to prove God's essence or his nature based upon scientific or philosophical proofs. One such example is Chovos HaLevavos. You've heard of that sefer, The Duties of the Heart. The first chapter after the introduction of Chovos HaLevavos is called Sha'ar HaYichud, the gate of unification or unity, which sets out to define God's unity and his essential characteristics based upon philosophical proofs and by an examination of nature. But there is also a tradition that is a counterproductive exercise. And the reason why some rabbis throughout the generations, and certainly by the time we get to the 18th century, that practice was no longer in vogue, it was viewed as a counterproductive exercise because there were many people who had become misubach, who had become bogged down and entangled in philosophy. Because, remember, any time, and we've talked about this a number of times already, any time you try to prove something through logic, you can always be presented with a counter-argument. So that, and this is certainly true of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, he definitely subscribes to this, our understanding of the Ribono Shel Olam and his world is not based on logical proofs. Because for every logical proof for A, there's a counter-proof or counter-argument to tell you B. And not one is not necessarily more compelling or convincing than the other. And therefore, were we to be left to our own design, argues HaLevi, we would not necessarily be able to prove the true essence of Hashem and certain basic truths that we believe based on our tradition. The Ramchal sounds like he's more on the side of the Rambam, who says that you can prove these things, or like the Chovos HaLevavos, Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Pakuda, who says that you can prove these things logically. But he still doesn't want to get into it because he recognizes that it's no longer in vogue and that it's very, very laborious. And through that laborious process of proving things scientifically and philosophically, you can become very entangled and confused and lost, ultimately. And this is really one of the reasons why that when, by the time we get to when you and I are growing up and we're going to our respective yeshivot and seminaries, or even elementary and high school, the teachers are basically given a tradition: don't engage children in philosophy, in philosophical discussions. Don't engage them. And not only that, but the teachers themselves do not have the grounding in philosophy to be able to have an intelligent conversation on these topics. And there are, for the most part, the basic idea that the Ramchal sets down is that this is our Mesorah, this is what we believe, and our depiction of God is based upon a tradition. I will tell you that for the most part, the way that it has come down to us is probably the safest delivery of a Mesorah. It's probably safer, the path that we have chosen over the centuries, to not engage in philosophical speculation about God and to rather rely on tradition. But it is nevertheless somewhat disappointing at times that we don't have people who can actually articulate philosophical arguments as well to help bolster some of the traditions that we have. And one should not think that the Ramchal does not know these philosophical arguments, but rather one should understand that he says the philosophical arguments exist, but my project is not to present them to you, because it's not something that I find to be productive for my ultimate goal, which is to present you with the Derech Hashem, the way that God runs the universe. Not how can I prove it, because that's not what I'm working on right now. Realize that if a child asks, how do we know? How do we know? How do we know? How do we know? And he's not satisfied with, this is the tradition that's passed down to us, the Har Sinai. It is important to tell that child there are ways to prove this as well philosophically or scientifically. And there is something called the Shar HaBechina, that you can go out into the world, like the Chovos HaLevavos says, and demonstrate God through nature. And it's a mitzvah to do so. But every child has a different tichuna, every child has a different makeup. And some children are satisfied with hearing just this is our Mesorah. And other children and adults are not satisfied with that. And we need to know that there have to be educators who are equipped to be able to tackle both kinds of students. One of the failings of our educational system is that we haven't produced experts in these areas of science and philosophy who can actually engage those inquisitive students and answer their questions intelligently. Okay, let us go on. Next page. It is also necessary to know that God's existence is imperative. It is absolutely impossible that he should cease to exist. This is purely a philosophical lexicon, purely philosophical language. God is the only being whose existence is necessary. Right? The Rambam uses this in his depiction of God as well. Everything else, right? Everything else is, right? You know that old phrase, no one's irreplaceable? Except for one. God cannot be replaced. If God were to not be there, then there would be nothing. And he says that. It is furthermore necessary to know that God's existence does not depend on anything at all. His existence is intrinsically imperative. He does not rely on anything else. It is likewise necessary to know that God is absolutely simple, having no parts to him. At the same time, all types of perfection are present in him, contained in his being without being separate parts of it. Unity is also part of that very important philosophical definition of God, because anytime something is made up of separate components, it is by definition imperfect. The greatest perfection is unity. And the more unified something is, the more perfect it is. So God is the ultimate perfection, and therefore the ultimate unity. This, of course, links Judaism to Islam as well, which places tremendous emphasis on unity. It's important to know that Muhammad, who is the founder of Islam, is living at a time of great philosophical speculation as well. And therefore, perhaps part of the emphasis on the unity of God is based upon this philosophical imperative. Okay. Now, we can try to understand this by observing that the human mind has many different faculties, each with its own area of activity. Thus, for example, memory is one domain, desire another, imagination still another, and none of these faculties impinge on the other. Memory, for example, has its own domain as does desire, and desire does not penetrate the domain of memory, nor does memory enter that of desire. The same is true of all the mind's faculties. The human mind can therefore be said to have structure that is not simple. So he's talking about the medieval philosophical depiction of the mind, that the brain is not made up of different faculties. There's the imagination faculty, there's the memory faculty, and they're all interrelated, but they're all distinct components. God, however, does not require a separate domain for each of these powers. In fact, he does possess these powers, which in men are different from one another. For God, we can say, does desire and is wise and capable and is perfect in every conceivable way. On the other hand, God is actually one, these phenomena being present in him without being separate parts of him. They're being included in him by virtue of his perfection. All types of perfection exist in God, not as phenomena which are separable from his absolute oneness, and it is impossible that God not possess every perfection. Again, using philosophical language. But essentially what he's saying is that when we talk about God having certain attributes, like being wise or desiring something and so forth, these are terms that we relate to as being separate components within the human personality, but for God they're all one and the same, because God is the absolute unity. Admittedly, this is something far beyond the grasp of our understanding and imagination, and there hardly exists a way to express it and put it into words. Our intellect and imagination are only capable of grasping things bound by the natural limitations created by God, since these are the only things that our senses can detect and convey to our minds. We are incapable of conceiving these different qualities as a simple essence, since among created things they are different, separate concepts. We begin our discussion, however, by acknowledging that God's true nature is beyond comprehension. No inference can be drawn to the Creator from what we see among created things. The nature and essence of the two are not the same at all, and it is therefore impossible to draw any parallel between them. So, what he's basically telling us is there is nothing within your frame of reference that will ever help you understand God. You can only use analogies, but they're very, very distant analogies, and you'll never really be able to truly understand Hashem by anything that is within your purview, because nothing is similar to God. Nothing in this world is similar to God, not even concepts. So, how do we do that? How do we even suggest that we do that, because the Torah does depict God in human terms? The Torah does anthropomorphize God? That's the dilemma, and that we have to. That's why there's a constant need to emphasize this idea. Despite the way that Tanakh depicts God as angry, compassionate, merciful, loving, desirous, all-powerful, and so forth, nevertheless, these are all borrowed terms. Lisaber et ha'ozen, you ever heard that term before? To help the ear process information about God. But they are very, very distant metaphors for an essence whose true essence we will never understand. Yes?
So I understand, Dibra Torah, the Lashon Adam, that the Torah speaks with those terms, so we will understand it. But I remember you said something in a different context. God feels sad when we don't do the mitzvos. And it just struck me at the time, I understand you're trying to convey that God feels disappointed, but it sounds like we have the power to make God sad. And if he's God and he's perfect, then obviously we have no power over him. So when you say God feels sad when we don't do the mitzvos, how could it be if we have no power over him?
That's a great question, and the answer is that you're confusing the first half of the shir of the lady shir with the second half of the lady shir. And what I mean is we all have to be somewhat schizophrenic. We all have to have split personalities in the way that we relate to the Ribono Shel Olam. We have to understand that on the one hand, God is so lofty and exalted that we will never truly understand him or connect to him in any real way. And at the same time, we are told that God is ultimately immanent and close, and that we can connect to God in the most intimate of ways. When we study Jewish philosophy, we're supposed to conceive of God in the former way. And when we study inspirational words of Torah that are supposed to help us live our lives properly, we're supposed to relate to God in the latter way. Sorry for the stuffiness.
Okay, I'm sorry. No, I thought that they were finished vacuuming, but I guess they're not.
No, usually with doors are open, but sometimes we can't control the cleaning schedule. Okay. So therefore, this, however, is also among the things that we know from the tradition discussed earlier. It can also be verified from the laws and principles of nature that it is impossible that some being not exist unbound by the laws and limitations of nature. Meaning that if there are laws of science, there must be a being who created those laws of science and transcends them. So there must be a being who is outside our system, who created the laws of physics and the laws of nature, and that being is who we call God. And therefore God, because he's outside that system, is unbound by those laws, by those restrictions. That's the logic behind it. It must be impossible that this being cease to exist or have any deficiency. This being must furthermore be divorced from all addition, structure, relationship, comparison, or any other quality that exists in created things. He is again using a fully philosophical nomenclature. Finally, this being must be the true cause of everything that exists and happens. Unless this is true, the existence and continuance of things as we know them would be utterly impossible. Okay, so we'll just finish the chapter. Among the things that it is also necessary to know is that God must be absolutely one. It is impossible that there exist more than one being whose existence is intrinsically imperative. Only one being can possibly exist with this necessarily perfect essence, and therefore the only reason all other things have the possibility of existence is that God wills them to exist. All other things therefore depend on him and do not have intrinsic existence. We therefore see that there are six basic principles involved in our understanding of God. Where did he get these? Where did he pull these out of a hat from? Where did he get these six things? Were they written in the Gemara somewhere? Written in the Mishnah somewhere? Okay. This is where philosophy and Torah intersect. My friends, this is where you have to understand. Where did the Rambam get 13 principles of faith from? Is it written in the Gemara somewhere? Okay. Again, you have to understand that these rabbis are operating not under a vacuum. They are operating in a world where they have to reconcile the philosophical understanding of God with the Torah understanding of God, and this leads them down certain ways of defining Hashem. So the facts of his existence, his perfection, the necessity of his existence, his absolute independence, his simplicity, his unity. And if you take a look in the first five, I think it's the first five of the Animamins, you'll see that that's also part of the way that the Rambam defines Hashem. Although I think that one of them is missing from the Animamins. The Rambam defines, tells us that there are imperative ways of believing in God. The first five of the Animamins are really what the Ramchal is quoting from, and he's adding one. So you look at the Animamins. Animamin, Bemuna Shalema, I believe with complete faith, that God creates and guides all creatures, that he alone made, makes, and will make everything. Number two, I believe with complete faith that there is no uniqueness like his in any way, the unity of God. That's the second Animamin. Okay, he was, is, and always will be. Number three, I believe with complete faith that the Creator, blessed is his name, is non-physical and is not affected by physical phenomena, and that there is no comparison whatsoever to him. Okay, and what would that be? That would be his absolute independence, probably, of any of physicality, or perhaps his perfection. I believe with complete faith that the Creator, blessed is his name, is the very first and the very last. his eternality. And I believe with complete faith that the Creator blessed is his name. To him alone is it proper to pray, and it is not proper to pray to any other, because no one shares God's station as being the ultimate necessary entity. Okay, you see that the Ramchal is really basing himself on the Rambam, and my whole objective in doing this with you is to demonstrate to you that we will see Rabbi Yehuda Halevi endeavoring along the same lines to try and define Hashem to the best of our ability, while at the same time distancing many of the ways that the Tanakh describes him by telling us that the Tanakh did it because Dibur Lash Torah Kaloshen Bnei Adam L'Saber Et HaOzen, to help us be able to appreciate a God and to describe God who is truly indescribable. We will continue, even though we didn't read any of the text of the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi today, we'll continue Mirtz Hashem next week on page 143. Let's go on.